Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Here's Johnny.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'll have what she's having.
To infinity and beyond.
CJ Johnson is here with us, lecturer in cinema, president of the Film Critics Circle of Australia. Hello, CJ. Welcome.
Hi, Suzanne. How are you? I should correct you. I'm vice president these days.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's all right.
VP.
Yeah.
There you go. Still important. And I mean, just in our little intro there to the movies, we do have that quote from When Harry Met Sally, I'll have what she's having, which has gone down as one of the great quotes, hasn't it, CJ?
Yeah, absolutely. If you're going to talk about Rob Reiner, you kind of have to play that clip.
So what we're going to do tonight is talk about some of the greats of the movie business who died this year. We're going to look back at their films. So on our list, we've got Rob Reiner, Diane Keaton, Robert Redford, Gene Hackman, Terrence Stamp. So CJ, let's start with Rob Reiner. I mean, he did some acting, but really best known as a director.
Yeah. I mean, as you say, he did some acting. He was phenomenally successful as an actor in a phenomenally successful show that I don't think probably had any impact at all in Australia and might not even have ever been shown in Australia. It was called All in the Family, and it was very much an American sitcom. And it was based on an English sitcom, whose name I don't even know. But the whole thing about it was it was centered around a grumpy old white racist man. And Rob Reiner played his son, who had different political views, who was left-wing and a bit of a hippie, because this was a TV show from the 70s. And Rob Reiner's character, I understand, was called Meathead. I've never seen a single episode of this show, but this show is legendary on American television. This was a major, major, major show. And it dealt with major political issues in the context of the show, because by having this racist, sort of old-fashioned grumpy man as its protagonist, it allowed people to have combative arguments with him. That was the basis, I understand, of the show and of the comedy. And somebody will know the name of the British version, which preceded it, I'm sure. And so it was supposedly really quite a provocative and interesting and challenging and smart and very, very funny show. It was a big hit for Norman Lear, who I think also died this year in his late 90s, who is the most successful television sitcom producer of all time. And so that was Rob Reiner's sort of big TV role as an actor. And then he transitioned into becoming one of the most successful Hollywood studio directors of the modern era, and especially of comedies. And it was in his genes, you know, he grew up around it because his father was Carl Reiner, who was a phenomenally successful comedian who directed films, who wrote films, who acted in films, who did sketch comedy, produced television, directed television, acted in television, wrote gags for other comedians, did stand-up. I mean, he was a true man of comedy, and that's the household Rob Reiner grew up in.
So it's no wonder. Now, Lockie's checked it out for us. The British sitcom was called Till Death Do Us Part.
Till Death Do Us Part, yes, which I've never seen an episode of either, way before my time.
I know. If anyone's seen All in the Family, I'd love to have a review of it from you too, 1-300-800-222. So his first directorial debut was This Is Spinal Tap. I mean, we've just seen the sequel come out.
That was his first, was it? That was his debut, was it?
I believe so.
Wow, what a debut. I mean, This Is Spinal Tap is one of the great films of all time. And by that, I mean, besides being hysterically funny and remains hysterically funny, and if you've never seen it, watch it tonight. Watch it at 2 a.m. if you need to. This Is Spinal Tap, 1984. But it was one of the most influential comedies of all time. Because if you don't have This Is Spinal Tap, then, for example, Ricky Gervais never creates The Office. Mm. You know, you don't have the mockumentary format, because that's what This Is Spinal Tap is. Now, I guess before This Is Spinal Tap, there were fake documentaries that were comedies, but I can't name one. You know, I think it really did sort of come up with an entire new way of framing comedy. And the thing about This Is Spinal Tap is, until you realize it's a joke, you don't, because it's so well made. It feels like it's real. And the Spinal Tap band, the fake band in the subject of the film, were actually a band. Like, even though they were a bunch of American comedians and Canadian comedians playing these English guys in this band called Spinal Tap, they wrote all these songs. They could actually play all these songs. And they actually, after the film came out, went on tour and played this huge tour. And people went to see them and they played full, you know, full concerts. And yes, so as you say, there was a sequel this past year called This is Spinal Tap. What was it called? The Final Legend or something, or The End Continues, or some good, funny, sort of clever subtitle. But it was lovely.
Yeah. Now, let me play. I mean, this is one of the iconic scenes from This is Spinal Tap. People will know what's coming.
The numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board. Oh, 11, oh, 11,
and most of
11.
And amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes, you're going to be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up, all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
See, I have seen that scene or heard that scene at least 60 times, and I'm laughing right now. Yeah. I mean, it is just the best. And this is the thing about Rob Reiner. You know, the three films of his will go through. All of them have iconic scenes like that where you've heard them a million times and they still make you laugh. I mean, it's so, so clever. So in that the American voice you heard was Rob Reiner because he's playing the director of the film This is Spinal Tap in This is Spinal Tap, except his name in the film is Marty something or something like that. So he's playing he's got a character name like they all do, but he's really playing himself as well because he is Rob Reiner directing the film and he plays the director of the film. And he's at the beginning of the film, he introduces the film and says, you know, hello, I'm so-and-so and this is my film about Spinal Tap and da-da-da-da, which all contributes to the whole feeling that it's real. And he's very, very funny in the film as a version of himself. Mm. And he's in the sequel as well, which if people haven't seen, it came out this year. It's very charming. It's not as funny as the first by any means, but it's very charming.
Now, Davrilla says, This is Spinal Tap was so quirky and well-made. It even fooled my friends who are longtime musos. And Eleanor from Bunyip's called in. I'm actually getting a few SMSs saying, actually, All in the Family was on telly in Australia. Is that right, Eleanor?
Yes, it was. And it was our favourite show.
So what
Edith, Edith was the mum, Archie was the dad, Meathead was the useless son, Roy was the glamorous teenage girl.
Yeah, so Rob Reiner played Meathead. What was he like as an actor?
He was funny. He was terrific.
Oh, good. Good. And he
played like the dumb son and he was bullied by his dad. So I just had to set the record straight because.
And Eleanor, what years was it on telly in Australia? Someone sent an SMS 70? Saying, yeah, right, maybe CJ, you and I are just a little too young.
Way too young. Oh, well, that's good. I'm glad it played on.
You get all these young people as experts and they go, no, it was never in Australia. I'm like, it was our favourite show.
I'm glad to hear that. Thank you. I'm glad to
Thanks,
be corrected.
Eleanor. And look, you get to be called young because of that too, CJ. We both do.
Now, that means because every clip I've ever seen of it is in colour. But when did she say it was on?
In the 70s.
Right, in the 70s. Whoa. So it might have played here in black and white because we didn't get colour television until sometime in the mid-70s, I believe. Mm. And so they might have played it here in black and white. Even though it was shot in colour.
Eleanor's still here. Eleanor, did you watch it in colour or black and white?
Colour.
Oh.
Interesting.
In the 70s. Okay.
I can't remember. I can't recall exactly when we got a colour television in Australia.
Well, I know we didn't get one until about 1980 and we were always behind with the technology.
Right.
So probably at least 5 years before that. Hey, Eleanor, thanks so much.
Thanks, Eleanor.
Okay. Now, the next one that we should talk about when we talk about Rob Reiner is The Princess Bride, which is a classic.
Oh, my God. The Princess Bride is so good. And of the three that we're talking about, The Princess Bride may be the least seen, which doesn't mean it's not very well seen, but it might be the least seen, and it is just a joy. So ostensibly, The Princess Bride is a children's story, but it's so not. I mean, it is. You can take a child. It totally works for a child, but much of the humour is great for any adult as well. It's written by William Goldman. It's one of his finest scripts, and it is just so funny. I took my daughter to see a screening of it at the Ritz Cinema in Randwick a couple of years ago, and we were sitting in front of a girl my daughter's age and her grandmother, and to my left there was a girl my daughter's age and her mother, and to my right there was a slightly older girl and her father. I mean, just everyone was taking their daughters to see The Princess Bride because it is sort of the ultimate fantasy for a little girl. But also, as they're watching it, you like you show them this is Spinal Tap, and 10 minutes in they're saying, wait, is this real? And you show them The Princess Bride and they think they're watching a fairy tale about a princess, and then 10 minutes in they're like, this is so funny.
Yeah.
You know, because it's taking the fairy tale and it's simultaneously spoofing it while also giving you a great version of it.
Yeah.
The cast is absolutely incredible. Billy Crystal's in it, and
Robin Wright was in it, wasn't she?
Robin Wright is the princess. She's That's the Princess Bride, and no one had ever seen her before. They found her, and she was just, you know, they needed to find the most beautiful princess in the world, and they found her in that. Chris Sarandon plays her dastardly prince that she's going to get married to or something. But Cary Elwes, this English guy that they found to play the hero, had just the most angelic face. He had this incredibly gorgeous blonde lock of hair that hung down over his eyes, and you just desperately, desperately wanted to see them together throughout the whole film. There's sword fighting. There's rodents of unusual size. Do you remember the rodents of unusual size?
I've only seen it the once, so I don't. But I know there are some great lines in it.
Oh, I've seen it about 12 times. There's the Battle of Wits with Wallace Shawn. Andre the Giant is in it as a giant, and he's in the whole movie. I think it's the only film he's ever in, but it's not like he's in two scenes. He is literally in the whole film, and he's terrific. It is just so wonderful, I can't tell you.
All right. Where is the poison? The battle of wits has begun. It ends when you decide and we both drink and find out who is right and who is dead.
But it's so simple. All I have to do is divine from what I know of you. Are you the sort of man who would put the poison into his own goblet or his enemy's? Now, a clever man would put the poison into his own goblet because he would know that only a great fool would reach for what he was given. I'm not a great fool, so I can clearly not choose the wine in front of you. But you must have known I was not a great fool. You would have counted on it, so I can clearly not choose the wine in front of me.
The Battle of Wits, which is just one of the great scenes.
Now, here's some more intel. Colour television officially started on the 1st of March, 1975. So that makes
Dead centre.
Yeah, and that would go with All in the Family being run in the late 70s when you and I were too young to be watching telly. But quite a few people are saying it was rerun in the 90s. Someone's saying, yeah, I watched it when I was at uni in the 90s.
Well, we weren't just too young to watch it because we were too young to watch telly. We were too young to watch it because of its content too. Mm. I understand it was really quite prickly, you know, and it was often controversial and everything because they were tackling big themes, especially, I understand, they really sort of tackled racism head on quite a lot.
We're talking with CJ Johnson, who is a lecturer in cinema, vice president of the Film Critics Circle of Australia. We are talking, well, about those people in the film industry who died this year. So we're taking an opportunity to talk about their work. If there's someone that we've forgotten, we're talking about Rob Reiner right now, but on our list, we've got Diane Keaton, who else are we going to
Robert
talk about?
Redford.
Robert Redford, maybe Val Kilmer if we get time.
Terrence Stamp. Gene Hackman.
Yes. And actually someone, Philippa texted in, where was it earlier, just on Terrence Stamp. I would have watched Terrence Stamp walking the garbage bin out. He's just divine. I always loved him. He was a very beautiful looking man and a good actor, says Philippa. Well, we'll get there later. Right now, and if you'd like to be part of the conversation, 1-300-800-222. RSMS is 0467-922-702. When Harry Met Sally, gosh, this was my favourite film for so long, CJ. I just love it. It's so funny.
Really?
It's the greatest rom-com, surely.
That's very interesting. Well, there's been a lot of rom-coms, but it is certainly
love,
one
actually.
Of them. Oh, my God. What isn't? Terrence Stamp taking the garbage out is better than Love Actually. Yeah, When Harry Met Sally, it has an argument to be made to be the best rom-com of the 80s, and there were a lot of rom-coms in the 80s. It is just absolutely fabulous. It's got all the right magic going on. Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan, they were both incredibly right for their roles. It's got some iconic scenes, obviously. Many, many iconic scenes. And the sort of the basic idea of it is a nice one, which is two people, what they wonder about whether or not they can be platonic friends.
Well, Harry is absolutely convinced that men and women cannot be friends because the sex part always gets in the way.
Right. That's, and he's right, right?
Sort of, yes.
Yeah. Turns out he's right.
And they're debating this for years, and she absolutely hates him when the first time she meets him, but she comes around and then they become friends and then the sex part gets in the way.
Right.
And then at the end they get together.
Of course, because it's a rom-com. So tell me about this, because clearly when you've got Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan, from the sort of 1989 male gaze point of view, Meg Ryan's a cutie. What was Billy Crystal?
Well, I don't think, though, her looks are played upon. I mean, she's never wearing kind of anything low cut. She's, in fact, dressed quite conservatively through most of it. I think it's entirely personality driven.
Oh, no, no, no. I know. Oh. I agree. But what I'm saying is I think that he's quite interesting casting because I think she looks
like an ingenue
of a rom-com, but he does not look like a handsome man. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean.
He's not that type.
And, he's not Brad Pitt.
Yeah, and, or Glenn Powell or one of these types, you know, and that's why that's another thing that I think is quite interesting about the film is, you know, that the underlying the whole premise, which is we can't be friends, you know, because man, and a woman, if they're friends, at some point the sexual thing comes in the way. But there's also the idea that she is not actually going to be lovers with him because she's in a different league physically.
Do you think? Okay.
I think it's subtext.
Okay. All right. Now, unfortunately, we don't have the most iconic scene from the film because perhaps that might not quite be appropriate. But we do have the very ending where they decide that, yes, they will fall in love and be together.
I'm sorry, Harry. I know it's New Year's Eve. I know you're feeling lonely, but you just can't show up here, tell me you love me, and expect that to make everything all right. It doesn't work this way.
Well, how does it work?
I don't know, but not this way.
How about this way? I love that you get cold when it's 71 degrees out. I love that it takes you an hour and a half to order a sandwich. I love that you get a little crinkle above your nose when you're looking at me like I'm nuts. I love that after I spend a day with you, I can still smell your perfume on my clothes. And I love that you are the last person I want to talk to before I go to sleep at night. And it's not because I'm lonely, and it's not because it's New Year's Eve. I came here tonight because when you realize you want to spend the rest of your life with somebody, you want the rest of your life to start as soon as possible.
Oh.
How many times have you seen this film,
Suzanne? I literally
just recited
that pretty well entire quote along with it.
Oh, my gosh. If our listeners could have only seen, Suzanne was literally miming that entire thing, both characters, and just, oh, my God. So have you seen it a dozen times?
Probably. Right. I've also got excellent recall.
Yeah, I
do remember a lot. But, favourite film for so many years.
Yeah. I mean, it's very well written. You know, you can sort of, you can hear the cadence and it's very, very clever.
Yeah.
But isn't it interesting, like, listening to him deliver those lines, he even doesn't sound like, you know, your typical leading man. He's got this very sort of, I mean, everything about him is curiously, I guess it was the same era when Woody Allen was constantly casting himself as the leading man in romantic comedies. You know?
What I think is so wonderful about that is so many rom-coms, the characterization of the two leads, it's shallow. In this case, you get to meet two actually incredibly imperfect human beings, all their bizarre quirks. You know, Sally, as he said, can't order meals, and that's the whole thing, the way she takes so long to do it. So that's what I think I love about it. You actually really feel the closeness and feel the bond, and I think that's what makes it work at the end.
Mm. And Rob Reiner worked a lot with Billy Crystal. Billy Crystal's in The Princess Bride, and I think they worked in a bunch of other films, you know, still going on. I think they became incredibly good friends. Like, I think Billy Crystal's one of the people who's sort of had to be reached for comment over the last week.
Yeah. And so here's a little interesting bit of trivia. Rob Reiner was actually divorced when they were filming that, but then he met his wife, Michelle Singer, on the set, and then they changed the end of the film because originally they weren't going to get together.
What?
But then he was in love. and he thought he'd get them together. Isn't that nice?
Yeah, he didn't write it. It was written by Nora Ephron, right? So, yeah. But I guess maybe he called up Nora and said, "Hey, yeah, that doesn't seem possible to me because it is a rom com that drives towards that ending. I wonder where that intel comes from."
Well, Ryan apparently told The Guardian that.
Oh, really?
In a 2018 interview.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I've got to believe him.
Oh, my goodness. Jackie's saying we actually played the inappropriate scene in full a few weeks ago. Well, not on my watch, but okay. If it's already out there. I think
that scene has been played on every radio station and television station around the world so many times. I don't think it's inappropriate anymore.
True. I've certainly been, and I've sat at that that table where she has the lunch. And
Sat at the orgasmic table.
Yeah. Oh, okay. It was when Greta was hosting. That explains things.
I'll have what she's having. Yeah. That's the line. We all know
it. CJ Johnson is here. Oh, Lockie, you're responsible, are you? Whew. You're more risque than I gave you credit for. CJ Johnson is here. Now, we are talking about some of the actors, the directors who've died this year and really taking this opportunity to talk about their body of work. So let's talk about Diane Keaton next, CJ.
Okay, well, Diane Keaton was sort of, she would have gone very, very well in a Rob Reiner movie. In fact, I'm now wondering if there's any intersection of their credits, because she was right up his alley in terms of her comedic skill. And indeed, she, like, you know, she could have been in a film like When Harry Met Sally, because Diane Keaton was the absolute rom-com queen of the 70s and going into the early 80s, because she was Annie Hall. And Annie Hall, Woody Allen's 1977 rom-com, is, for my money, you were saying before When Harry Met Sally, and you said surely it's the greatest rom-com of all time. I think you could argue that Annie Hall might be the greatest romantic comedy ever made in the history of cinema, in any country, in any language, you know, since the beginning. It is okay, just
Nightlifers,
brilliant.
Annie Hall v. When Harry Met Sally. What do you say? Send me your SMS.
There's others too. I mean, there's many from the 30s and 40s that would also make that claim. But I think perhaps in the modern era, to me, Annie Hall is it. And to me, you get When Harry Met Sally because of Annie Hall. Mm. You know, Nora Ephron loves a movie like When Harry Met Annie Hall, and then she writes her own sort of version of it with When Harry Met Sally. And I think it inspires all the rom-coms that come in its wake throughout the 80s and into the 90s. It's and one of the things that makes Annie Hall so special is that Woody Allen met this woman, Diane Keaton, and I think he pretty much wrote the role for her, and he allowed her to bring a lot of herself to the role, including, I understand, bring her own sort of fashion sense. And so the Annie Hall character is very, very distinct in her fashion, which Diane Keaton brought to the role and which inspired, you know, this whole huge fashion trend out of this movie, which was very, very successful. And it really gives the film a stamp, because it has the stamp of Diane Keaton now within it, because the character is much, much closer to her than, for example, maybe Sally is to the real Meg Ryan, you know what I mean? And since Woody Allen basically was always playing a version of himself, the film becomes incredibly, incredibly intimate and personal and real, because you've got Woody Allen's Woody Allen and Diane Keaton's Diane Keaton masquerading vaguely as these two characters. But you see what I mean? It's really, because it's not just him, it's her as well. And they didn't have a long-standing relationship. I think they had a very, very brief relationship and then realized that they were much better as friends. And then they remained friends for the rest of her life.
And they could be friends.
Sorry?
In this case, men and women could be friends.
Yeah. And they were. And I think their relationship was already over by the time they made even Annie Hall. I think they had it when they were in a play together. Before that, I think, when they were in the Play It Again, Sam, on Broadway, which was years before. So they were already past that. And they were able to just play the most beautiful, beautiful, funny, funny, tender, wild, wacky scenes. And you just bought both of them. And she just... oh, she's mesmerizing in it and funny and gorgeous. And, you know, she became a sort of, before there were memes, you know, there were all sorts of things she said and did that became sort of the equivalent of memes in popular culture.
Like what? Do you have an example?
Well, la-di-da, you know, this is one of the things that she said. And yeah. And the way she, as I say, the way she dressed. And that's just one of the many, many, many great films of hers.
All right. Now, I've got a scene from Annie Hall. Alvy and Annie, who've just met playing tennis with friends, start to talk afterwards.
Hi. Hi.
Oh, hi. Hi.
Well, bye.
You play very well.
Oh, yeah? So do you. Oh, God, what a dumb thing to say, right? I mean, you say it, you play well, and then right away I have to say you play well. Oh, God, Annie. Well, oh, well. La-di-da, la-di-da, la-la, yeah.
And there it is.
And there it is. She had this ability, which all, I mean, it's you're kind of describing acting when you say this, but she had this ability to not only make it seem real, but make it seem so spontaneous that it was hard to believe that there was a script. Do you know what I mean? It sounded so real that it sounded beyond even improvisation, as though it was a documentary, but of course it wasn't. It was a scripted film.
Now, Catherine says Diane Keaton was in a Rob Reiner film with Michael Douglas. I've just checked out And So It Goes.
Which, haven't seen that.
Yeah, I think it was a 2014 American comedy drama.
Yeah, they both made, Rob Reiner directed a lot of films and Diane Keaton was in a lot of films. And there's a kind of, there's a whole Diane Keaton career post 2010 that I haven't even seen. There are a whole bunch of films that I am so not the demographic for, but that came out and are very, very successful. I think the last real Diane Keaton film I saw and absolutely loved, and this is going back to the 90s, was The First Wives Club. But she had a continued to have a career deep into her 60s and 70s as the lead, as the star. And she was still making romantic comedies. There was a whole sort of type of movie that was a sort of a Diane Keaton rom-com for the over 65 brigade.
Yeah, I've seen one of them now that you mentioned. I can't remember what it was called, but I've definitely seen one of them. So from the 70s, what are some of the other movies of hers that you would really point to?
Oh, well, you've got to go to Looking for Mr. Goodbar, because Annie Hall was, you know, this ultimate rom-com, and she was playing the ultimate rom-com heroine. Looking for Mr. Goodbar is the opposite. This is a really, really dark film. So, and it's so sort of not how we picture Diane Keaton. You know, when I think of Diane Keaton, I only think of happiness and light. You know, she's smiling, she's laughing, she's wearing cool clothes, she's a kook. But that's not what Looking for Mr. Goodbar is. So it was based on a novel that was, I gather, a real cause célèbre, like this very successful and scandalous novel. And I think I remember my parents having a copy on their shelves. I don't know if you grew up in this sort of house, but I grew up in this sort of house where, like, there was this shelf of, besides other books, there was a bookshelf of paperbacks. And there were a lot of those sort of, those books in there. And I used to sometimes check those out and I was like, oh my God. And this was one of those books. And then it was turned into this film. And the film, I'd always heard, like, oh, I shouldn't watch that film. You know, this is a dark film. This is a scary film. This film could be traumatic to watch. And so I finally only watched it for the first time in my life about 3 or 4 years ago. And boy, it's really intense. So she plays a woman who is looking for love in New York City in the 70s. And she starts going to bars. She starts picking up guys in bars. And it doesn't end well. I'm not going to say anything more. That's all you need to know. But it's a pretty brutal piece of work. And anyone who's seen it is nodding their head right now.
Okay, if that's you, let us know what your experience was, what you remember of watching Looking for Mr. Goodbar. Now, someone saying favorite rom-com is His Girl Friday. Are you familiar with that one?
Of course. That's a great film. Yeah. But that's from the 1940s,
okay.
Early 1940s.
All right. So far, just a couple of people saying not into Annie Hall.
Oh, right. Oh. Well, that's interesting.
Well, I think Woody Allen's reputation has definitely taken a hit, hasn't it?
Yeah, but I wonder if that's it or whether they're just not into it. You know, it's fair enough. Mm. It won the best film at the Oscars in 1977, beat Star Wars.
Now, from Tony, just saying, we lost the wonderful actress Prunella Scales. While she'll always be remembered as the long-suffering wife of Basil Fawlty in Fawlty Towers, she was also a great stage and screen actress and a comic genius.
Huh. I certainly remember her from Fawlty Towers. I can't think of a single film that I know her from, but she might have been one of those people who's in a bunch of films and I just never clocked it.
I think she did a lot of stage acting, certainly in the UK too. Mm. Yeah. So that was Diane Keaton, who died in October, aged 79, and quite shocking. People didn't really know that she was sick, so there are a lot of people very surprised to hear that she died.
And I think also because she continued to make these light romantic comedies, you know, into her early 70s, that I think no one had this sense of her as vulnerable. You know, she seemed like someone who was just going to live forever because she was just, she was so youthful in spirit that it seemed hard to think of her as old, even as, you know, the physical signs of age were obviously appearing on her. She didn't feel old, you know
no,
what I mean?
No, I absolutely agree.
Whereas, I don't know, like a couple of years ago when we all heard that Paul Newman died, we were like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. You know, he was getting on.
Well, and that brings us to Robert Redford, who was 89. Who died in September. I mean, also one of the great actors too of the 70s.
Even more than that, I've been doing a lot of watching of Robert Redford's films since he died, and I've been watching them chronologically, and I'm starting to think that he was one of the all-time greats, like one of the all-time greats. His work on screen, but besides getting into his work as a director and then his work as the creator of the Sundance Film Festival, and we'll need to get to all of those things to properly honour him, his work as an actor is unbelievably truthful and mesmerizing. As a young actor in films like The Candidate or The Hot Rock, The Hot Rock is just a fun little heist movie, and yet you can't take your eyes off him. And he's so good at playing stillness, and he's so good at understating and underplaying and playing truthfully, but he's also, and you can see this right from the early performances, he is one of the best thinkers on screen you've ever seen. He can just sit there, if someone lobs him a question in a scene, he'll sit there and he'll think about it for a second, and then he'll answer. And theoretically, that is dead screen time, you know, you're watching somebody do nothing, but what you're actually watching him think, and you can see that he's thinking. He exuded intelligence, which you need if you're going to get an audience to sit there and watch you think. And so you were thinking, like, what's he thinking about? What's his answer going to be? And that's brave, because most actors aren't brave enough to do that, especially when they're young in their careers. Most actors are like, well, there's my line. I've got to volley my line back. But he was always willing to think about it. And it gives his performances a great richness. And he just got, you know, better and better and better with age, all the way through to a film like in 2018 called The Old Man and the Gun, where he's magnificent. Gosh, he was really good.
So why don't you point out which films you think we should, you know, what are the top perhaps three Robert Redford films?
Oh, the top three is a bit not fair, but let me think. The top three. Well, in terms of just sheer watchability, like his greatest films, probably Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid has to be his greatest film. That is sort of a perfect movie. It's hysterically funny. It's him with Paul Newman. They bounce off each other terrifically. It's romantic. It's got action.
I do have a clip. Yeah, it's where Butch and Kid are on the edge of a cliff preparing to take on the posse who are pursuing them. And Butch Cassidy says, well, jump.
If the water's deep enough, we don't get squished to death. They'll never follow us.
How do you know?
Would you make a jump like that and you didn't have to?
I have to, and I'm not gonna.
Well, we got to, otherwise we're dead. They're just gonna have to go back down the same way they come. Come on.
Just one clear shot, that's all I want.
Come on. We got to.
Nope. Get away from me.
Why?
I want to fight them.
They'll kill us.
Maybe.
You want to die?
Do you?
All right. I'll jump first.
Nope.
Then you jump first.
No, I said.
What's the matter with you?
I can't swim.
Why, are you crazy?
The fall will probably kill you.
You can hear how good they are together. And theoretically, you know, because then they made another movie together called The Sting, which is a magnificent movie about a couple of con men in the 1930s in Chicago pulling off a sting, pulling off a big con on another criminal guy played by Robert Shaw. And it's still lovely and they have great interplay in that. And really, I think something happened. I think the two of them just were such big stars that they just couldn't work out deals where they could make a whole bunch of films together. Because theoretically, they could have been like Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon. You know, they could have just made film after film after film together and we would have bought them up. But he was always very happy to share the screen with another great male movie star. You know, there's not so many rom-coms in his... In his filmography, he's often with another major male actor. And I think the other film that would be vying to call itself his best film is with Dustin Hoffman in 1976, All the President's Men, where they play the journalists Woodward and Bernstein, who basically cracked the Watergate story and brought down President Nixon. And that film is just extraordinary. And it's nail-biting. You know, it's the all-time great journalistic thriller. It's one of the great all-time sort of true story movies. And once again, you're really watching these two guys methodically go about their work and they're thinking a lot and they're writing and, you know, they're thinking and writing and spitballing ideas in a newsroom, and it's absolutely thrilling.
Julie says, Robert Redford, forget the acting. It's all about the jawline.
Well, she can say it's all about the jawline, and she probably has a point, but I'm going to argue there's a lot of good hair in there too. Like, I've been watching his early works, his early to mid-70s work, and I am thinking, along with, you know, looking at the qualities of the filmmaking and the directing and the humor and his performances, I'm thinking like, okay, this is this hair here, this is a 7, oh, this is a 9, this one. And the one I just watched last night, The Candidate, his hair's a bit shaggy for the first 20 minutes, but then he gets a haircut within the narrative of the film, and it goes from being sort of a 7 to a 9. I mean, he had really good hair. Absolutely. You're just staring at his hair sometimes, and then you forget, you know, oh, I should pay attention to what he's saying. His hair was, it's a character of its own.
Retrospective on Robert Redford's hair for you on Nightlife tonight with CJ Johnson, Vice President of the Film Critics Circle of Australia. And on Prunella Scale, someone says she was in Hobson's Choice. And someone else just saying Manhattan Murder Mystery with Diane Keaton and Woody Allen.
That's what you said. Well, they made a lot of films together. Thank goodness. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we should mention that he was instrumental in founding the Sundance Film Festival.
Yeah. This is really. I mean, besides his acting, he also directed. He won Best Director, and the film won Best Film in 1980 at the Oscars. The film Ordinary People. He also made. So he directed quite a few other films. One I would recommend highly is called Quiz Show, which stars Ralph Fiennes.
Oh, yes, I've seen that.
It's
excellent.
Really good. Yeah. It's a really good movie about a radio quiz show scandal or an early television quiz show scandal in the States in the 50s. Very, very strong film. But in the 90s or late 80s, early 90s, he established this thing called the Sundance Film Festival, and alongside it, the Sundance Institute and a bunch of other sort of supplementary sort of non-profit companies. And it became the most, very, very quickly, it became the most important film festival in the United States for independent film. And it actually became the most important film festival in the United States, period. And it coincided with, and it's because he could see this happening, the sort of the emergence of independent cinema in the United States in the 1980s and going into the 1990s. So he gave these kind of films a platform. And the great thing was, I mean, people would enter these films that they had made completely independently, you know, for $30,000 that they'd borrowed from their dentist, and they'd sent them in, and the Sundance Film Festival would show them, and the critics would go to the Sundance Festival and review them in places like Variety or The Hollywood Reporter or The New York Times even, and all of a sudden these films would get released out not only into America but out into the world. And I'm thinking of films like Go Fish, for example, this tiny little wonderful lesbian comedy drama from 1994 made on the smell of an oily rag. And, you know, all of a sudden we'd be able to see them here at the Academy Twin in Sydney. And it was all thanks to the exposure that they got from the Sundance Film Festival. So it has always, from the very beginning, found and highlighted and amplified, and it's made so many careers. There are so many people who owe their entire filmmaking careers to the fact that Sundance picked up their first scrappy little film that before it existed would have really had no place to go. Mm. Because once you've borrowed $30,000 from your dentist and made your film, and you've spent the $30,000, then what? You know, how do you, nobody, you've got a film sitting on your desk in you know, wherever, Idaho, but then what do you do? Well, once you had the Sundance Film Festival to submit it to, boom, 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 and the next thing you know, the New York Times is reviewing it, and suddenly Christopher Johnson, C.J. Johnson is seeing it at the Academy Twin in 1995, which is what happened to me seeing Go Fish. Yeah.
Lee in Saratoga says, I saw The Sting in the cinema when I was quite young. It got a standing ovation at the end in a cinema. Can you believe it, says Lee.
I love it when people clap in the cinema. I'm all for it. I sometimes after a good film, I try and start one. I get one going.
How can you talk about Robert Redford and rom-coms without mentioning The Way We Were, says another texter.
It's interesting. I guess it's a rom-com. I mean, I would call it a romantic drama rather than a rom-com, because it certainly doesn't have the sort of the tropes and the structure of a rom-com. It's interesting. I've seen The Way We Were twice recently, and I don't think it's one of his greatest films, but it's certainly very good in terms of the Robert Redfordness of it all. He looks gorgeous. His hair is running a 9.5 in that film, and his wearing of sweaters in that film is very, very powerful.
Kathy, who sent that in, says Carrie Fisher and the girls swoon about The Way We Were in Sex and the City. That'd be Carrie Bradshaw, I think. Yeah, they talk about
in terms of the way that the camera frames him as a gorgeous man, that The Way We Were might be the top. The film is a bit problematic because it can't really decide whether it wants to focus on the politics or the romance, but they're really good together, Barbara Streisand and him.
CJ Johnson is here. We're talking about some of the actors and the directors who've died this year and just looking at their body of work. And we should move on to make sure that we've got time to pay proper justice to Gene Hackman, CJ.
Yeah, talk about a big career and talk about a big life. I mean, he lived longer than any of them. He died in February. He was 95 years old. And it's interesting because thinking obviously about the awful, tragic way that Rob Reiner died, if you think back to February, the Gene Hackman death was also quite shocking, because as the details emerged, it was an interesting story, as it turned out, journalistically. So I don't want to talk about it because it ended up kind of sad. But if you want to go back and remember it, it was quite interesting. Anyway, he gave us a million great films. Some of his highlights were, well, his absolute classic without a doubt is The French Connection from 1971, which is one of the all-time great American scuzzy, gritty, gnarly, dirty New York City buddy cop movies, where he and Roy Scheider play a couple of cops who are out to bust a heroin ring that's emanating out of France. That's The French Connection. And he's really not a good guy. He's racist. He breaks the rules. He goes outside of protocol. He makes a lot of mistakes. And Popeye Doyle is the character's name. And Gene Hackman just plays the heck out of him.
I have a little clip from The French Connection.
I've got a man in Poughkeepsie who wants to talk to you. You ever been to Poughkeepsie? Huh? Have you ever been to Poughkeepsie?
Hey, man, come on, give me a break. Hey, I don't know what you're talking about.
Let me hear you say it. Come on. Have you ever been to Poughkeepsie? You've been to Poughkeepsie, haven't you? I want to hear it! Come on!
Yes, I've
You've been there, right?
Yeah.
You sat on the edge of the bed, didn't you? You took off your shoes, put your finger between your toes and picked your feet, didn't you? Now say it!
Yes!
All right. You put a shoe on my partner. You know what that means? God damn it! All winter long, I got to listen to him gripe about his bowling scores. Now, I'm going to bust your ass for those three bags, and I'm going to nail you for picking your feet in Poughkeepsie.
So it was from The French Connection, 1971.
Yeah, that's like one of the famous scenes, and it makes no sense really just listening to it. You think, like, what is he talking about? But it's one of the methodologies that this cop uses famously is that he says all this nonsense stuff and gets these people to say this nonsense stuff because he's really trying to psychologically disarm them to get them admit to the fact that they're carrying bags of heroin or selling bags of heroin, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's police brutality, but he's a brutal brutal police person in this film. I mean, it's based on a couple of real cops, and it's based on a real case, but it's fictionalized, and his performance is exquisite. And then just a couple of years later, he plays a very different character in a film called The Conversation by Francis Ford Coppola from 1974. And I would say it's his second best film and his second best performance, and he's just awesome as this sound recordist who's taking, who's recording some sound, and he realizes that he might have picked up the sound of two people planning a murder. And it's just this marvelous film about a guy who's forced into becoming essentially a detective of sorts. And even though that's not sort of what he wants to do, it's absolutely thrilling. Ooh, just talking about it makes me want to go home and watch it. And I've seen it probably 10 times.
Right. Also on your list, you've got No Way Out from 1987, Unforgiven from 1992.
Yeah, those two I put there because what he does is, which is a thing that so many sort of actors of his era did when they were a bit older, is after he sort of gets into middle age, he sort of stops playing the lead and he starts playing the villain, and he becomes very good at playing villains. And in No Way Out, he's just a really, really good corrupt American. He's either a senator or a congressman, one of those American politician types. And then in Unforgiven, he's just a horrible, horrible bad guy sheriff, I think. I think he's a terrible, awful bad guy sheriff. And he was really good at playing the bad guy. I mean, he was never the prettiest face on the block. You know, he was no Robert Redford. And actually,
not even his hair?
The worst. Oh. If Robert Redford's hair was often between an 8 and a 10, Gene Hackman's was 1 or below. I mean, just the worst. I think he had like six pieces of curly hair sticking out of the top of his head, and that was it. I mean, you know, he was basically. And this is the thing. See, he became a star basically when he played the brother. This is a laugh, that he would play the brother of Warren Beatty. He played Warren Beatty's brother in Bonnie and Clyde. You're right. You know, most gorgeous man in the world and like one of the ugliest movie stars ever. And he became a star then. And I think he was already, if he wasn't already 40, he looked 50. And he was already basically bald, and he has the Gene Hackman mug. And he was an unlikely sort of movie star because he certainly didn't look like one. And you know, none of the roles he played were glamorous. And I don't think there's such a thing as a Gene Hackman rom-com.
Now, a couple of people chiming in. Carmel in Ballarat says, an excellent documentary on Hackman aired earlier in the year showcased his wonderful acting versatility, comedy, drama, violent, nasty. He could do the lot. Jeanette says, please mention Mississippi Burning. I've never forgotten it.
Yeah, that's a good film. Once again, he always plays, he was a tough guy. You know, that was the main thing he played. And whether he was playing a cop or a bad guy, he was always just sort of intimidating. Very, very, for want of a better word, he was a very sort of masculine actor.
Let's talk now about Terence Stamp, who died in August, aged 87. And I think probably, you know, in recent years, certainly best known for The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Yeah, very opposite to Gene Hackman. I mean, I was just using a sort of outdated word for Gene Hackman, a very masculine actor. But the moment you talk about Terence Stamp, you can actually sort of apply that, because Terence Stamp was not a very masculine actor. He was always very much in touch with his femininity. He was always, whereas Gene Hackman had this sort of brutalism, Terence Stamp was beautiful. He was pretty. He had unbelievably gorgeous blue eyes, and he had this beautiful blonde hair, good hair, Terence Stamp. And, you know, he was this handsome, angelic looking Englishman who made women swoon, because as you had a caller from earlier saying, she'd watch him take out the rubbish. And he grew up to be just this guy who ultimately got cast in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert as now I want to get the terminology right. I suppose he was that film. The other two were drag queens, and he was a cross-dresser, or he might have been transgender. I'm not sure, actually. I'm not sure the character. But he lived in dresses, and he was able to play that with aplomb.
Yeah, and he played Bernadette, and this is one of the classic scenes from Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, featuring Terence Stamp.
Could I please have a stock?
No! You can't have
You can't have nothing. We've got nothing here for people like you. Nothing.
Now listen here, you mullet. Why don't you just light your tampon and blow your box apart? Because it's the only bang you're ever going to get, sweetheart.
Well, I was concerned about playing the orgasm scene from When Harry Met Sally. But
thanks for playing that. That was a good one. Oh, wow. That was the ABC. He was so good in that film, and he had many, many great lines like that. He really, it's an iconic role for him, but that was not his only iconic role by any means. He also was in The Collector in 1965, a fantastic role for him then. The Limey in 1999, a Steven Soderbergh film. But he was also famous to a bunch of people for playing General Zod in Superman 2 in 1981. And a lot of kids got to know him through that. He was fantastic.
Yes, Sandra's agreeing. Terrence Stamp. Yes, stunning eyes. Loved him as the young Billy Budd.
Well, yes, that was his first role, Billy Budd. And that was sort of this, it was the perfect example because he was gorgeous and pretty and seemed vulnerable because of that. And to take this sort of gorgeous, vulnerable, pretty young man and put him on a ship under the lash of this horrible, horrible captain. And it's a story of abuse, really.
A couple of people also mentioning Gene Hackman in The Birdcage. One texter says he was hysterical. Allison says he made an attractive woman at the end of The Birdcage.
That's good. I mean, Gene Hackman was very good at comedy. I think his greatest comedic role was in The Royal Tenenbaums by Wes Anderson.
Oh,
do you remember him
film.
In that?
Yes.
Oh, he's got this amazing line where, like, his kids have put on all his pressure, gone through all his trouble to put on this play, and they've done it for him, and they've done it. And someone says, "What do you think of the play?" And he's like, "What play? Bunch of kids in animal outfits."
Now, we've got less than a minute left. So, look, the other people that we should just mention, Val Kilmer, of course, for Top Gun, Julian McMahon.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. That was sad and unexpected.
Yeah. David Lynch.
David Lynch. Well, David Lynch is the other huge, 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 major, major filmmaker of the year that passed away. Gosh, we could do 2 hours on him.
We could. Well, CJ, we will say goodbye. You, as I said, are actually going to be joining us for This Week in History next weekend to talk about the Lumiere brothers.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I'd forgotten entirely, okay, so that's good.
Don't forget that. So we will talk, the listeners will hear from you then. Thanks so much for all your contributions.
Merry Christmas. Happy New Year, Suzanne.
There's CJ Johnson. CJ is, of course, our regular film guru, a lecturer in cinema, a vice president of the Film Critics Circle of Australia.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.